After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Everyone out there who's watching or listening right now, here is my wonderful friend who I have been beseeching to come and do podcast, Mirabai Bush. Hi, Mirabai.
Hi, Raku.
I'm happy you're here.
Me too.
So for those of you who don't know, I mean, I think if those of you that are listening, of course, many of you are aware of Ramdas.org. Ramdas, I'm sure you're aware of. And that you got an announcement last fall about Ramdas's new book with Mirabai Bush called Walking Each Other Home. But in case you didn't, now you know. And there's the book right there. Fantastic. We're going to do a bunch of things today, but of course we do want to reference it. It's an absolutely gorgeous book. And, first thing I want to talk about though, When we were in India, so everybody, I mean, we have done a couple of podcasts, Mirabai and I, over the years, last couple of years. And so many of you do know that Mirabai went over to India after Ramdas went back the second time. And there is where we met, at the feet of Neem Karoli Baba, alongside of other people you know, like Krishna Das and Rameshwar Das and so on. While we were there one day, and I'd like you to tell this story because it kind of fits in with things that I've been really thinking about lately. Okay. And that is when you got your name and you went there, you were with your partner, right? Not husband?
Yeah. Was it? Were you partner married? Then, yeah.
Right, you got married later.
We did.
Okay, tell that story.
Okay, let me think. Well, when we were with Maharaji, he would often give people names. And, you know, as you probably know, the first time Ramdas went to see Maharaji, he gave him the name Ramdas. And in the Hindu tradition, it's a practice to receive a name and then to figure out how to live into that name. So Ramdas's name is Servant of God. So he had dedicated his life to the divine. And so we all wanted a name, and Maharaji just, he would give them out. I mean, he would just say to someone, your name is, you know. And so some people got names soon after they came, and some waited months, years.
They weren't in good shape, too, after some time.
Ramesh got his name on the day he was leaving to go home.
Really? I don't remember that.
Yeah. So it was always a thing among us getting a name. Yeah. And my name was Linda and before. And Maharaji used to call me by name, call me Linda. But the way he said it, it sounded like Nanda. And I thought, oh, he's going to name me after the bull. You know,
Shiva's bull.
Terrible. Yeah. Shiva's bull. Nandi. Please don't do that, Maharaji. Anyhow, a lot of time went by. And then one day, I guess I'd been there maybe a year, he said, your name is Mirabai. And then he said, do you know who Mirabai was? And I said, no. And Radha, a friend, was sitting next to me, and he said, Radha, you tell her. And Radha did know the stories, that the original Mirabai was a queen in, I think, 16th century Rajasthan. And she was, she had become, from the time she was a girl, she became a devotee of Krishna. She had her little altar in her room, and she would sing to Krishna, worship Krishna. But she was in a family, and in India, usually whole families are devoted to or committed to a particular deity. And this family was devoted to Shiva. And so her mother and father-in-law are very unhappy with her for worshiping Krishna. And so they tried to get her to stop, and she wouldn't stop. And so then they tried ways to get rid of her. And so one day they sent her a snake, a poisonous snake in a basket. And when Mirabai, since she was so pure, when she opened up the top of the basket, there was no longer a snake there, but there were beautiful flowers. So
if you think you have some parental issues going on, everybody listening out there, I don't think it compares. Or in-laws. Yeah, this is okay. This is beyond the beyond. Yeah, so turned into flowers. Sorry.
Yeah. So then and they tried again. And this time they sent her a cup of poison that looked like, you know, tea, I suppose. And when she drank it, because she was so pure, it turned into Amrit, which is the nectar of the gods. So Mirabai didn't know quite what to do. She was at risk of losing her life. And so she packed up and left the palace. She left everything she knew, and she left all the kind of riches and ease of life in the palace. She sang in the streets to Krishna, and other women gathered around her. It was very unusual in the 16th century in Rajasthan, but she did it. And the songs that she wrote are poetry, still exist. They're still sung frequently in India. And in this country, a number of American poets have translated. People like Robert Bly and Jane Hirschfield have created great translations of Mirabai's love poems to God. And so when Maharaji gave me the name, Radha told me the stories. And in some of the stories, it's the in-laws. In some of the stories, some of the ways the stories are told, it is her husband who sends her the poison.
That's the only way I understand it, was the husband.
There are many versions, you know. So anyhow, my friend, boyfriend, who would later become my husband. I don't think we were married yet.
No.
Maharaji married us at some point. He jumped up and ran away toward the gate of the temple. And if you've heard any of the stories about being with Neem Karoli Baba, you know that none of us ever left unless we absolutely had to. And even then, when he would tell us to go away, we would just not want to go, and we'd sit as long as we could. So somebody getting up spontaneously and running away was unheard of.
After he heard this name being given to his partner,
yes,
Mirabai, and he knew the story. He obviously did know
the
story.
He heard the story. Yeah.
Yeah. Heard, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So he got up and ran. And then I think either Krishnadas or Ramdas went after him. Maharaji said, go get him and see what's going on. So maybe it was Krishnadas, and brought him back. And Maharaji said, why did he run away? And Krishnadas said, because Maharaji, he didn't want to be the husband who keeps his wife from God. He figured that if I was getting the name Mirabai, that he was part of the story too, and that he would be the cruel husband. Maharaji said, this is one of my favorite things he ever said to any of us. He said, why does he think that way?
And then he said, mine too. Favorite thing ever. It's what I was thinking about and why I said, you got to tell this story. Because this, go ahead.
So then he said to him, his name was John then, he said, your name is Krishna and you shall be called by that name. So why did he identify with the cruel husband instead of Mira's real lover, who was Krishna? So many times I have like chosen the low road or the kind of grim possibility or the dumb way of thinking about things. And then I said to myself, why do you think that way?
Yeah. It's a mantra. It's a mantra. It's fantastic. I mean, we've been thinking a lot of and talking a lot with different people on Mind Rolling about how stuck we get in our stories and how much we believe in our thoughts and so on. And this mantra, why do you think like that, is, to me, it's a big antidote to the way in which we get lost like that and the way in which we like to beat ourselves up, too. I mean, I'm the shithead husband who poisoned my wife. I'm not the god of love. Why?
Right. In fact, we're all both. But if we identify with the god of love, we're more likely to act in a better way.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. That's absolutely it. Mirabai, everybody who doesn't know, Mirabai has been involved and founded a wonderful NGO or nonprofit, Contemplative Mind. And they've done work in so many different areas of society, not only to the most natural people that would be interested in meditation and so on and so forth. Mirabai's led excursions into both Google and the Army as two different, way different kinds of organizations. And so, so you have been involved in this a long time, and I know how many people you meet. I mean, you know, it's extraordinary, really. But so all the work that you're doing, the conditioning that we all have had in our lives that leads us to wrong view, basically the Buddhist idea of wrong view, that conditioning is so, so very strong. I mean, just in your own experience, have you had, do you have an optimistic feeling about people being able to work with their stuff, quote unquote, and be able to change that conditioning? And I know you're friendly with people like Richie Davidson, who has done a lot of work, you know, and there's all these people working around neuroscience and so on. Yeah, talk about that a little bit, would you?
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to bring up Richie. Well, yes, I did, starting in 95, with the Center for Contemplative Mind, we had the intention, mission, to introduce contemplative practices, meditation, yoga, and so on, into secular settings in America. And at that time, they were only being used in health and healing, the work that Jon Kabat-Zinn and Dean Ornish and even Dan Goleman were doing in health and physical and psychological healing, but not anyplace else. It's hard to remember now because it seems that at least, you know, mindfulness and yoga are everywhere, but then not at all. And we worked in all these different sectors, you know, with scientists and business leaders and in higher education, with philanthropists, journalists. And yeah, I saw so much change because these are people who had not done any of this before. And so, you know, in the beginning, often the change is very obvious. Later on, it gets a little subtle, shall we say. But right around that time, Richie was starting his research on the neuroscience of meditation. And he and the others were able to do that because scientists had for the first time acknowledged neuroplasticity, which is the ability of the brain to change all the way through life until the very end. Mm. You know, they used to say, you know, old dogs can't learn new tricks. I was happy to hear that.
They can.
In fact, they can. Not only can they, but we do. We keep changing all the time, and our brains are being changed by what we experience. And so if you intentionally experience something like the disciplines of meditation or yoga or chanting, or then it is going to change your brain in a certain way. That research and just the kind of acknowledgement of neuroplasticity really actually helped us enter a lot of these domains because science, you know, and we were working with kind of successful leaders in all these different fields. And so they were all very committed to, you know, critical thinking. And we worked a lot with lawyers and judges, for example. So, but yeah, I not only saw it in people who, you know, wanted to talk about it after they started going through changes and seeing things in different ways and recognizing that in any moment there are choices. And if you're quiet and open enough, you're able to see what those choices are. And then, so not only did I see it, but the science was confirming it at that time. So yeah, the answer is yes.
Yeah. What do you think's the most effective way to turn around our conditioning? Is it in my own thought around that, it's really a combination of awareness, mindfulness, awareness, and meditation. That if not also a little work with a little therapy work to really get at what exactly the neurotic tendencies are. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that different practices help us change in different ways, and also that they're different people respond well to different practices. And so it's really finding that right match. I think that people respond to different practices at different times in their lives. I know after having done, I don't know, 20 years of a mix of mindfulness meditation, insight meditation, yoga, and kirtan, I went through a really hard time in my life. And I could not sit still and be quiet. I mean, my mind was just racing. And I know you're just supposed to come back to the breath. But, you know, I tried. And then I tried walking long contemplative walks. Nothing was working. Actually, I went to Joseph Goldstein during that time. I said, Joseph, I can't do it. Mm. He said, Mirabai, Joseph is so great. Mirabai, Zen masters would kill for this opportunity.
Really?
Of being so disturbed that you have to work really hard to get quiet. But it wasn't working for me, not being a Zen master. So that's when I started doing Aikido. And so, which was very physical. And I realized that after 5 years of doing Aikido, I never once had a thought on the mat other than you know, what I should be doing or what was going to happen next. I think it was because I was so terrified that I knew I had to pay attention. I shifted into a different way of waking up, and it really helped me. And then since then, other things. But so I think, first of all, it's really important to know that, you know, there isn't a practice. And people might think that these days, because mindfulness is everywhere, you know, and what's called yoga, although there's so many different kinds, is kind of everywhere. But, you know, there are many, many practices, and it's important to find one that works for you. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, kirtan really opens the heart so that you stop thinking about other things, because you're not in your thinking mind, you're in your heart. When you stop, then when the kirtan is over, there's a kind of cleansing that's happened to your mind, so that there's more, you can more clearly see what's happening in the moment and what the choices are. And that's what we want. We want that that clarity of mind and heart, so that we can see the nature of reality.
Yeah, that clarity through whatever practice.
Yeah,
the resultant clarity is absolutely 100% necessary to see the motivations, to see the projections, to see that we really don't know nothing. I mean, we are, there was a thing with our friend Bob Thurman, and he was talking about emptiness and talking about ignorance, and of course, the source of suffering is ignorance. But even worse than ignorance is wrong knowing. And then you start to think about how much stuff you know, I know, in terms of everything, our whole lives. So getting some clarity to back that up is extraordinarily important.
Yeah, that's really good, how we're so convinced we're right about the way things are. A couple of things come to mind. One is, maybe the only good thing about this current political moment we're in is that you can see people on all sides of whatever issue it is are absolutely sure they're right. And you know, we're not always right, even though we're completely sure that we are. Another funny thing about perception, just that we leap to assuming certain things. And one morning, my older sister she always had trouble in the mornings. She was always kind of dopey in the morning and liked to have her coffee, you know. So she came downstairs, sitting at the kitchen table. She was having her coffee and she had her glasses on. And for some reason, a lens popped out of her one side of her glasses and fell into the coffee. And she said, "Oh my God, there's ice falling from the ceiling and I'm going blind." Isn't that great?
Oh, that's really great. That sums it all up. Yep. Oh my God.
Yeah. I mean,
and that's happening, everybody. Yeah. Don't we agree, everybody, that we do that, I don't know how many times a day? Get it wrong, you know? So clarity is the byword, that's for sure.
Yeah. And that process in insight practice and mindfulness practice, that the process of questioning, inquiring into your mind, looking to see what's really there, that is such good training.
Yeah, absolutely. You glossed over what's going on today, but I thought I thought I wanted to read something from our friend Annie Lamont.
Oh, good.
That she has about this. And it's about the most, you know, toughest of emotions to really deal with, and it's what's endemic for this polarization that's going on in the country now. How did we become so filled with hate? This is not who we are. Hate is the worst emotion of all, second only to acute jealousy. Certain special people of late have caused a majority of us to experience derangement. Some of us have developed hunchbacks or tics in our eyelids. Even my Buddhist friends have been feeling despair, and when they go bad, you know the end is nigh. Booker T. Washington said, "I shall allow no man to belittle my soul by making me hate him." Mm. And this is the most awful thing about it. Yet, part of me sort of likes it too, for the flush of righteousness, the bond to half the electorate. Who would we be without hate? That's terrific, right, Annie?
Right.
Oh, my God. But who, that boy, we are talking about again, the light of clarity into this reality. I mean, I am doing it whenever I see him or any of the, I guess Paul Krugman called morons. Do you see Paul Krugman's article in the New York Times?
Did he call?
He called them morons. I thought, wow, that's okay. I guess, you know, New York Times is hated so much, it doesn't matter what they say about it, you know.
Yep. It's a really hard time. I find that actually the hardest thing for me is that I've spent so much time.
Hang on one sec, Mirabai. I'm going to ask you. You got to stay there.
Sorry.
You can't go back and forth.
I spend so much time paying attention to this stuff. I mean, I really, you know, I want to be well informed so that I can contribute whatever is possible to healing the situation. But I spend much more time than I need to. I know that. And it's, I feel like my brain is like, I'm exercising it too much at a very superficial level, you know, just like hearing the facts of what's going on. And of course we know a lot of the times they aren't even the facts, you know, and paying attention to all of it. I was always well informed about the news, but I didn't spend the time I do now. But there is this kind of, I guess, what it is a, survival reflex that we feel like it's back to the time of dinosaurs or tigers anyhow. You know, I feel like I better know what's going on or something terrible is going
to
happen.
Yeah, you know, to me also, it's like, you know, there's a fire down the street. Let's pop over there, and then you find yourself there for about 10 hours watching a building burn down. So there's that kind of a thing, too. It's also horrible. And there's also the entertainment factor. All these networks are surviving on this factor in terms of the viewership. Sure. It's nuts.
Yeah. But, so it's a hard time. It's really, I mean, it's... I think about the kids. They're, you know, they're very exposed to it. They have to be. Just the way he talks about people and just the dehumanizing of many people, and especially people who he thinks are not like him. But one day, this is a while ago, when Trump bombed Syria. This is last year. So we were sitting around in chairs and talking about what had just happened. And my granddaughter, Dahlia, was sitting on the floor playing with toys, you know. And she loves the screen, but her father doesn't really let her near it most of the time. They don't have a TV and she doesn't have a iPad, but you know, she always likes to get near my phone if she can. So we're sitting there talking about it. She's at our feet, And then she looks up and she said, "Oh no, Trump bombed Siri." I realized that she was ready for Trump to do anything bad. Trump bombed Siri.
Yeah. Well, that's the indoctrination for one half, and the other half is the opposite. Oh boy. Yeah. Well, again, this is all to say that when we talk about mindfulness and we talk about neuroplasticity and the reality that one can change these habitual patterns, then we talk about what we're in right now, where we're having being confronted on a daily basis by this stuff in ourselves, polarization, yeah, separation, anger, hate, you know, the whole nine yards of it is a great opportunity,
yeah,
but a very, very difficult one.
It's almost like one of those old teaching stories that, particularly in Buddhism, they use them about there's always somebody who's like utterly evil, you know, and then what happens in relation to him. So, I mean, it gives you a glimpse of, or I should say, in as much as you haven't liberated loving kindness and compassion and care for others, if you don't do that, then you tend toward behavior that is like really harmful to others. And yeah. I mean, he's like this extreme example of it. But if it can encourage us to keep becoming more caring, loving, and, you know, people with wise discernment and a good sense of responsibility at the same time being loving and caring. I mean, I find him inspiring in that way.
I'm going to give you one more Annie quote, which kind of takes us into this wonderful, okay. I want to just talk about a couple of things from the book that around our whole conversation is really around this getting to this clarity point that shines a light on every aspect of our inner lives. Aging can be hard, she writes. It might have been useful had we not followed the skincare rules of the 60s, which were to get as much sun as possible while slathered in baby oil and basking in the glow of a tinfoil tanning reflector. I read this before. That's somebody else. It's like my mother. That was it. Your inside person, your soul, the innermost baby in the nesting doll of you, is close by when you despair about your neck, your failing vision and drive. But your inside person also knows that with myopia, cluelessness, and tiredness comes grace. And that's what Mirabai, this book, so embodies that you did with Ram Dass. It's really inspirational that way. And it, you know, people say, well, this is a book about death and dying. I always tell them, no, not at all. That this book speaks love on every page. Yes, that you will get some wisdom about how to deal with transformation and impermanence, right? I mean,
yeah. And you,
just talk about your own, just a little bit of your experience of that, and that what it did for you just in the doing of this.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, thinking about, talking about, reflecting on dying is really reflecting on life, because we really don't know, you know, what happens on the other side. We know what we can do to prepare for death itself. But it turns out that really the preparation to die well, die peacefully, die without regrets, is the same instruction for how to lead your life right now, every moment, fully and lovingly and well. So in talking, the good thing about bringing death into awareness is that most of the time we repress it. I mean, the culture supports us doing that. We don't, it's not part of most of our lives until somebody we love, someone close to us, dies, or we get a diagnosis, or we just notice that we're aging. But usually death isn't much of a part of life. And there aren't that many conversations around it. Even when a loved one dies, mostly with your friends, you'll talk about the person who died and so on. But rarely do we sit and talk about the ways in which we are frightened of dying ourselves. We don't want to look at it. I found that doing that was really transforming, that I don't think I had a lot of super fears about dying. I know I'm going to die sooner than before. and Ram Dass will too. So we spent about 2 years doing the book. Ram Dass living in Maui, and I was living in Massachusetts. So I would visit him. We'd sit in his room. We'd talk about it. And then we'd do some just being silent together. And then I'd go home and I'd write it up. I wrote it as conversations between us. So I just recorded them with my little iPhone. Then I went home and wrote it up, and then I'd go back again and read it to him. It went like that. So it took about 2 years to do. During that whole time, of course, it was foremost in my mind. I really know now, having gone through that, that I just have much less, I don't even know if it was fear before, but now it just feels much more intimate, more real, and easier. I feel like, and you know, I recognize who knows what will happen. You know, I might have some such deep-seated fear that it'll burst out in the end, but I feel comfortable with it now, and that makes my life day to day feel, it's hard to say, fuller, richer, easier. There's not this kind of thing out there that I don't want to think about. It all feels much more integrated than before. So I think that, or as someone wrote in one of the blurbs, you know, if you or anyone you know is in danger of dying someday, I recommend that you read this book. Yeah. So it's great. Really about living, although we did also include suggestions about how to be with someone who's dying, and also ways to go through grieving, and how to prepare for your own death at the very practical ways as well as spiritually. I'm just happier after writing this book. You all don't have to write it because we did, but I've been getting really great feedback from people who've been reading it.
By the way, it's not, it has a wonderful, all through the book, wonderful illustrations that it's quite beautiful, and it's a great gift. Those of you who want to pick it up because you don't have it, go to ramdass.org/shop, okay? I had to do that ad. One of the things that, in my own experience, and actually it came from a Ram Dass quote, and it made me realize something. I'll tell you about it, and then you can tell me your own experience. So, you know, Ram Dass talks about, and in the book, of course, you know from your experience that sitting with the dying is not just good service, but great sadhana, spiritual practice. Being with people who are dying is living on the edge of awakening. It brings me close to Maharaji Neem Karoli Baba, close to the mystery, and opens my heart to love. So this is, again, something I think I've mentioned before, but when my father was passing, Dasarath, maybe the day before, something like that, our friend Dwarka came down from Taos. We were in Santa Fe. And somehow he and I ended up meditating in the room with my father, who was he's still aware of who was around him. And he wasn't speaking, but he was aware. And there's a beautiful picture of Maharaji at the foot of his bed up on the wall. And I had this experience that is perfectly described by the edge of awakening. That was like just at a precipice of, I guess, from the two to the one. I mean, that's too intellectual, but it was just at a precipice of complete peace and quiet and not thinking time, no time and space. And in that moment, suddenly I had the realization, shit, I had the same experience I remember with Maharaji when I first met him. It was right, at, you know, and the edge of awakening is a perfect term for it. So then I thought, wow, you know, so it's like that was to me my birth, you know, a spiritual birth, obviously. And this was death, birth and death. And it all became one continuum. And it was profound in that moment with my father. And I'm sure that you've had similar experience here, especially going through all of this. And I know you, most especially, if I remember correctly, you had that kind of experience with your sister when she left.
Yeah. I actually wasn't there the moment my sister left. But I was, and I wasn't with my mother either, who, because there is a thing, what to say, common thing that happens when people die, that when nobody's in the room is the time they choose to die. I've been with my mother for 48 hours, not, you know, on the bed in the hospital. And then I just was exhausted and I went down the hall to take a little 20-minute nap. And that was when she died. But I was with my friend Mary McClellan when she died. And I'd also both birthed a child, you were there, and been in the room when other babies were born. And I remember that when Mary died, it felt, you know, as you said, you can't describe it, but there was an energy in the room that was so identical with the beginning and end of life. It's just being in the presence of the mystery. You know, where does this come from inside somebody's body? And then death, where does it go? It's really, it's so outside our capacity for rational understanding that it just, yeah, it pushes you to the edge, you know, and in a beautiful way. I mean, there's sadness when people die, but it's also, I just felt it's like a privilege to be that close to this mystery that is at the heart of our lives. How do we get here? What are we doing here? You know, and where do we go when we leave? You know? So yeah, that's, it's precious.
Yeah. Which is why, and Ram Dass says this all the time, has forever in his work with the dying people, he has said to people, do what you can to get close to people that are passing. Mm-hmm. You know, either in as a volunteer, and start when you're young. Because, you know, and how many teachers say, by the time you get older, you get a lot of infirm, shall we say, things going on that prevent you from actually even doing simple mindfulness practices. Yeah. So start when you're... But being around then, of course, we got a taste of that in India, because death is way out in the open in India. And especially if you go to a place called Benares, where people go to die and get burned on the banks of the Ganges. And there's one place called Monacarnica, where they've been doing this for thousands of years. I mean, it's just 24/7. So a meditation there goes a long way to some deep self-investigation, shall we say.
Yeah. And for people who are witnessing their loved ones being burned, or their bodies being burned, I'm sure that I haven't had that experience, but I'm sure that that's an incredible teaching of recognizing that the body is not who we are. And you know, Ram Dass has it in Hawaii, in Maui now, they got a permit for outdoor cremation. The only other place in the country is Colorado. Chogyam Trungpa was burned on a pyre outside Boulder. But so Ram Dass is planning to be the first person in Maui. And I just, you know, we pretty much finished the book and I was busy saying, oh, I think I've given up all my, you know, attachments around death and Ram Dass's death, because we talk about it a lot. And then he told us that, and I thought, oh no, that is going to be, if I'm still around, that is going to be really hard. And of course, Ram Dass said, it's spiritual practice. That's why I want to do it. It's not for me, he said, but for everybody else who's there. Yeah. I'm sure it will be.
Yeah, I know. He told me that as, yes, I'm going to be burned in an open casket, in a pyre, and outdoors. And
yeah,
I said, are you absolutely certain that we are going to have to live through this? You're going to do this to me?
Yeah, that's how I felt.
I can't believe you do that.
Yeah. You said, yeah, I'll be good for you.
Yeah, right. God.
Yeah.
In the book, and more towards the beginning, actually, to me, one of the most crucial aspects of being able to integrate the mystery in a way that banishes fear, shall we say, Ram Dass talked, the main preparation for dying is giving up any sense of separateness. When you feel separate, it's very painful. And then if you think of that in every aspect of our lives, inner lives, outer lives, everything we just discussed about what's going on in this country and the vast separation, and then the feeling like that we are this, you know, individual me, and everything we think and every story we tell ourselves supports that, living in that separation, unless that tree is cut down, as Bob Marley said in one of his songs, it's very, very difficult to even think of cozying up to the idea of impermanence, the idea of moving on in a transition, separation. Did that come up more in your talks with him?
Just the the whole importance of separation and recognizing that it's artificial.
And what are the potential ways in which we can transform that mm-hmm. it goes back mm-hmm. to, of course, yes, everything we're talking about, neuroplasticity and changing habitual patterns and so mm-hmm. on. But this is the biggest of all.
Yeah, it's the biggest of all. And that's why the wall is such a symbol.
Yeah, right.
But, we talked about practices also that help us remember, help us dissolve the boundaries and remember the ways in which we are all interconnected. And and when that becomes real for us, we behave in such a different way. You know, it's, of course there are, you know, there are separations at the level of material things. We're in different bodies. But remembering the ways in which we are interconnected and that we are all, that our soul or spirit is all part of one, it changes everything. It changes. Then you find I mean, it's related to what the Buddhists are calling emptiness. It's not really emptiness. It's the it's that there are no false concepts, attachments there. And when that's gone, you can see and know that we are all part of the same thing. And then out of that naturally arises compassion and compassionate action, because why wouldn't I want to relieve your suffering since we're all connected? And there are, we do include various practices. And that the reflection on dying, you know, we know that when we die, we leave our body. And what is it that leaves the body? And where does it go? But that reflecting on that helps to remove that sense of separation. And then there's also that connection that you feel once when you reflect on dying, that, yeah, we're all, every one of us is going to die. And we all share that. I lead a practice often with different groups of people called Just Like Me. And in it, it's a compassion practice, and it's to remind us that although our differences are important and that we need to honor and celebrate our differences, is because that diversity creates a much more interesting creative world. But while we are honoring our differences, we need to also recognize the way in which we're all the same. And so that practice takes people through ways of in which we all suffer. And so you get guided in hearing, you know, this person has had physical pain and suffering just like me. And this person has been sad in life just like me, and their whole series. And then toward the end, the leader of it says, this person will die just like me. And it's such a powerful moment. You know, if every time, you know, we're with somebody, we took 1 second to look at that person and think, this person will die just like me. The kind of poignant compassion that you feel, you know that person doesn't want to die just like me.
Yeah.
And will. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a beautiful meditation. We should offer that out there, Mirabai. We should do that meditation in some form and allow people to access it. That would be a good thing. Another thing from the book, kind of maybe our last little quote, Ram Dass, you need to find first of all, just outside of the wonderful words of wisdom, the little in this book, the little day-to-day kinds of things, you hanging out with Ram Dass, that are presented, they give such a wonderful picture of what his life as it is now, and his day-to-day, and his day-to-day, he's no different than when he gets on a Skype call with somebody or he does a presentation. He's exactly the same all the time. So you write, once he's settled, Ram Dass says, this is how it is to be an old man. For anyone attached to self-image, it's hard. Anybody thinking about the past? He stops and is quiet, maybe absorbing the truth of what he just said. And then we sit in silence and we say, should we include something about aging in the book? And so there's a little bit more accounting of that moment. And he says, aging is freeing. Okay, this is a positive, yeah, everybody, about aging. fewer attachment. He said, I used to comb my hair concerned about my baldness. Now I comb my hair with levity. Who cares about baldness? And he continued, this is the wisdom part. You need to find a place to stand in relation to change where you are not frightened of it. Be with the changes, work with the changes, but at the same time cultivate emptiness. And we just, Mirabai just described a little bit of emptiness, and it's not about nothingness, empty of self-reference, you can start there, spaciousness, awareness, and clarity. Look, that word, it's there again. This is what the deep spiritual work of sadhana, spiritual path, is about. And so if we talk about separation being the biggest issue that we have to deal with in every aspect of our lives, accepting impermanence probably is, you got to start there, right? You got to start there. And I just head us back to the beginning of our conversation about the things that we can do to create a clarity so that we can see, we can have some really great inner knowledge, and we can take actions from that place that really start to change our life. And as Ram Dass has said many times, if we change our insides, and then we have an opportunity to radiate that out to others. So, yeah. Boy, it's fun having you here.
It feels almost like being in the same room, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, probably because there's no separation.
Yeah. That's the digital magic, you know, that's available to us. Well, thank you for being here. And is there anything else you want to say about this book? By everybody, I mean, it's really getting out there, and we are really happy, alongside of a lot of people, like Mirabai said, there's a bunch of feedback that it's being extraordinarily helpful, because the central thing of it is not death, it's love. Okay. Yeah. Conversations about loving and dying. Is that what it says?
And as Raghu said, it's loving. Beautifully illustrated. Yeah. But also we broke it into like little 2 and 3 page chapters so that it's, you know, it's a pretty intense subject, love as well as death. And but it's easy to pick up and put down and read. And then there are lots of practices at the back. And
it's good. You can take it to the bathroom too, because it's got short. I've heard people say that. Okay.
Well,
just want to get too much information here. And it's a great also conversation starter. You put it on your in the living room. Put it on the coffee table. Mm-hmm. Someone picks it up and go, "Wow." And you can get a whole thing going. Okay, we're going to think of 1,000
well,
reasons why
true.
You should have this
true.
Book.
Yeah.
No, mainly there's only one reason, and that's the love that you shared with Ram Dass that is so ever present in this book. That's really what it's all about. So thank you. It was my idea, okay, though? Okay, will you acknowledge that?
Absolutely.
We'll have links. Mirabai also has been involved with other publications that we want to turn you on to.
Oh, yeah. Here's a plug. Okay. Mindful.org just today or yesterday put up, from Mindful Magazine, just put up a thing on 10 powerful women and leaders in mindfulness. And there's me.
You're number one.
And there's Sharon Salzberg and many other people you probably
Tara
know
Brock,
would be great to learn from.
Yeah.
So, and it's a quick read. You know, they put it up because the Women's March is coming. But it's fun to read, and there's some really great women involved. Mindful.org.
Yeah, and we're also going to give you links. There's a book Mirabai did with Ram Dass that's an excellent book from 80s maybe. I'm not
90s.
Sure when. 90s, oh, okay. What's the name of that book?
Compassion in Action.
Yes, and that's a lot of work that Mirabai has been doing over the years as well. So we'll get links to everything and Mirabai's site and anything else, Mirabai, you want people to know about, you know, let us know. We'll put it in the show notes. And and we're inveigling Mirabai to start talking and doing podcasts. So we're going to get her to do that this year. So everybody look out for that. And happy afternoon.
Bye,
thanks.
Everyone.
Yeah, thanks everybody. Listening. Come back to BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling, and we'll see you again.